Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Men's Monday here on Mind Talk. Every Monday, you and I have the opportunity to meet another man who is willing to share his story with us. Today, I'm very pleased to introduce you to Mr. Ian Brown. Ian is described as an author, a feature writer, an award winner many times over. Ian, welcome to Mind Talk.
Pleasure.
Now, Ian, your most recent book, as I understand it, The Boy in the Moon, A Father's Search for His Disabled Son, was actually one of the New York Times' 10 best books of the year. Is that correct?
Yes, it was like the year it came out in the United States. I was hugely honored to for that to happen, not just for the honor, but because, you know, disability is a subject that people don't like to talk about. We don't like to think about it. I think people who are familiar with that world, they care about it. But, you know, disabilities remind us of our own disabilities, of our own fragilities, of our own, you know, of the fact that, you know, we all come to a bad end. It reminds us of our own deaths, of our own weaknesses. And so we prefer to have it sort of out of sight, out of mind, or have some kind of more bureaucratic solution to the problem. Whereas that book was an attempt to come to terms with my son, Walker, has a very rare disability called CFC syndrome. There's about 150 cases globally. Mm. And while that was very complicated, figuring that out and how to take care of him, because he's part of this new genre, you know, of human beings who are saved by medical science, brilliant. Yes. Medical science, but then they come home, and then the doctors, you know, send them home, and no one knows how to care for them. So it was difficult to care for him. But the more troubling thing for me, and the thing that made me want to write the book, is that I wanted to know what the value of his life is. I mean, I'm not a sentimentalist, but given that so much of his life is lived on the periphery, on the edge of so-called normality, I wanted to know what purpose his life might have, if it had any purpose at all. And it was trying to figure that out and coming to accept him as he is, as opposed to the way he was supposed to be. That's where the breakthrough. And so I thought that's what I was trying to write about in that book.
That is such a gift for anyone, to be able to be seen as they are and not who the onlooker would prefer them to be. Tell me a little bit more about the syndrome that your son is dealing with.
It's called cardiofaciocutaneous syndrome, or CFC syndrome. And it was actually named by a computer. Cardio is because some of the people who have CFC have cardiomyopathy. They have an enlarged or damaged heart. Cardiofacio, and the facio is for their facial dysmorphia. So they tend to have slightly lowered and rotated ears. They have very sparse and curly hair, and the giveaway for the syndrome is they have no eyebrows. They're sort of as bald as a spaceman kind of thing, and the eyebrow department. And then the cutaneous is they have very, very sensitive skin. But in addition to those are the mere symptoms that they use to recognize it. But and there's now there are some genetic markers for it, but there's a wide range of afflictions. You can go from normal, you know, being normal intellectually, to being quite severely disabled. And and when Walker was younger, he didn't sleep through the night. So, you know, you take turns getting up with him, and because he's also sort of functionally autistic, and so he hits himself if he can. Mm-hmm. So you have to stop that, and you'd have to lie in bed with him, holding him, and either having fun with him or trying to make him go to sleep. And so we'd trade off nights, and neither my wife Johanna nor I got, I don't know, two consecutive nights of sleep, I guess, for about 10 years. So, you know, all that is very difficult. But the more, like, he's now 20, he looks about 12, I guess, and
Interesting.
he has the mind of a year and a half year old. And he can't speak. Because he can't speak, we don't know how well he can see or hear or what's bothering him. Sometimes a lot seems to bother him. But at other times, it's always difficult. You can never sort of overestimate how difficult it is to raise a severely disabled kid. But you can, nobody ever, at the same time, adequately describes the many moments of not just sacrificial pleasure, but real grace and insight it can give you. I mean, it can. But you said earlier, that for him to be accepted as he is, as opposed to as he's supposed to be, that's a great thing, a great gift. But what happens when you have a relationship with somebody like that is, as I'm sure you know, it also liberates you, and it allows you to be, like me, to be the person I am as opposed to the person I'm supposed to be, because with him there is no supposed to.
Right.
We have to figure out the relationship we have moment by moment in situ, and it doesn't matter that we fail or succeed, or because there is no success or failure. All we can do is learn to be in relationship together, and that turns out to be an incredibly original and often incredibly interesting, intellectually interesting, emotionally interesting experience for me. I mean, I learn in that way, and I'm not a Pollyanna about this, as I say, but I must say that I have learned much more than I have. He has given me in that regard much more than I have ever been able to give him.
The experience of having a child who is disabled puts a tremendous strain, I know you know this, often on relationships, on families. What, if any, wisdom would you share with those who may be dealing with their own challenge within the family, whether it's with self or with someone else who's disabled?
That's a good question, and it strained our marriage, our finances. I have a daughter who's 3 years older than Walker, and she is everything he's not. I mean, she's brilliant and very articulate and graceful, and it changed her life, and gave her something to overcome, which is great as well. And helped and deepened her life. Not that she wasn't deep to begin with, but so I guess all of those things are sort of complicated. But I think the main thing is that for me, it was that I had to, I'm a pretty conventional guy, and I, for a long time, couldn't come to terms with him, couldn't write about him even, because I wanted him to be a certain way, or at least I kept expecting that he would be a certain way. But gradually, I'll just tell you a quick story. He does this thing, if he were in your studio, say, you'd like him. You can have a great relationship with him, even though he can't speak. He'll come over and he'll sit next to you. He'd sit in your lap if you were wearing some jewelry or something. He loves the shiny stuff and stuff he can touch. His most developed consciousness seems to be in his touch. But he'd, move around, and if I were there talking to you, I'd be, I'd be watching him. I've learned, even I have learned slightly to multitask, and I'd watch him, and I'd watch him, and I'd watch him. But eventually the moment would come when I would become distracted, and at that very moment, he would wreak major league havoc. He'd knock over some expensive audio equipment. He'd knock over, if it's a crystal glass, even better, and then he'd throw his head back and go, ha, 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 and hope that you found it as amusing as he did. And, I used to watch him doing this, and I used to think, my God, he's going to end up in the slammer by the time he's 18. I'm going to be, he can't talk, so we click, back and forth. So I'll say, hello, Walkie, how are you? Like this, and he'll say back to me, which I'm still learning click, but I think it means, how are you? Mighty Mouse is here, my boy, and he's going, yeah, I know, I'm over here. I've been waiting for you, blah, blah, blah. But I thought I'd be clicking to him, you know, through the plexiglass of a state penitentiary. But finally, after watching him do this 1,000 times, I realized that what he was doing was showing me that, and he knows he's not as capable as other people. I mean, and I think it discourages him and depresses him sometimes and certainly isolates him. But every once in a while, he could outwit me. He could outsmart me. He could be as smart as his, you know, smarter dad. And at first I thought, well, that must be, I mean, this revelation sort of came in two stages. And at first I thought, well, that must be kind of a, must be great for him, some kind of liberation to once in a while be as smart as his dad. But then I realized that the even greater liberation was my own, because as I mentioned before, I was freed from this, you know, all the incredible expectations that weigh upon everybody's life, and certainly upon most relationships between a parent and a child. I mean, there are other things, of course, as well, great love and fun and all that stuff. But there's, you know, there's that hod of expectations, like a load of bricks, you know, that sits on your back. And I realized that he had liberated me, not just to be him to be my equal, but for me to be his equal. And that was a fantastic freedom. You know, it allowed me to come back down into my body with him. It allowed me to be emotional with him. It allowed me to be only those things with him. And it allowed me to find pleasure in, you know, he doesn't talk. So when we walk down the street and he's in a kind of pushchair, I'll talk to him and I'll say, oh, look, walkie, you know, look, this summer, you know, that the white miniskirt is back. Or, you know, look over there, the Bulgarian butcher has not changed that side of meat hanging in the window for about 6 months. We are never eating a sandwich in there. And I'm not sure he can understand anything I'm saying, but he reacts to my doing this with, he's absolutely thrilled to be part of a conversation, to be treated as if somebody who can have a conversation, even if he can't in the formal way. And his informal participation turns out to be just as satisfying as if he was reacting. So, I mean, these are, you know, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but those are big, big, deep insights for me about what it's, how to be human in the world, how to be maybe a bit more human, how to be a bit less, you know, programmatic. And once I realized that that came from accepting him as he is, and not, you know, we talk about inclusion all the time. We attempt to include the disabled in our able-bodied world. Well, that's not fine when they're in school. When they get out of school, the rest of the world is not so inclusive.
That's true.
So you have to reinvent inclusion, and he helped me do that. So I think that the only advice I would ever give anybody is try as much as you try and improve their lives and make them better and make them healthier and get them a proper place to live, try just as much to accept them as they are and understand what it is they are saying, no matter how they say it, no matter how subtle their contribution may be, because there is always a contribution there. And the trick and the thrill and the challenge is to find it.
Oh, as I'm listening to you talk about your experience,
I'm sorry to blather on like that. I can talk about that stuff for a long time.
No, I actually find that it is really insightful, and I would imagine very helpful to some of the listeners who perhaps are having a same or similar experience. What I wonder about, because our task today was to take a look at a book that you have written entitled 60, A Diary of My 61st Year, and I wonder, as you look at your own aging process, and in the context of having two very different children, what impact, if any, the your two children, particularly your disabled child, has on your own experience of your own aging?
Well, that you keep asking these great questions that require, you know, hour-long answers. So I cannot help myself. And, you know, it's a fascinating question. I mean, first of all, you know, any parent of any disabled kid, any parent of any kid worries about what's going to happen to their kids as they get old, as their parent gets old, right? Are they going to be able to handle themselves? When you have a disabled kid, it's even more profound because you're not going to be here, and they need a lot of care, and you've got to figure out, you know, how they can get it. Is it fair to say to your other child, this is on you, you have to take care of this, you've got to devote all of you, and it's a 24-hour job, you know. You've got to devote to it, unless you have outside help or they live in a place where they can be helped and live, you know, in a community. I mean, is it fair to say that to my daughter? I do not think it is. I think I have no right to, and I never have, and I have always told her, you know, this is an accident of genetic, you know, a genetic typo. That's what causes, and your life is not going to be, you'll have plenty of your own challenges. You don't have to be out for this. So I've tried to find him a place where he will be safe and can live a good life, can live in a community whose tone he can help create, as opposed to just a care situation where somebody's taking care of him. I mean, and that's hard to do. Those communities are real communities where the disabled set the tone, and we, the able-bodied, are the ones who have to be included, right? We're the ones who have to adapt, as opposed to them adapting to us. That's hard to find. But so that's a whole other level of the challenge. But what I... And then there's this business of, you know, so it took 10, maybe 15 years, you know, to get to a point where we had stasis again in our house. Because, you know, it's like dealing with all the parents I know who had disabled kids, you know, they'd show up at the school every morning. And you could always tell which ones were the disabled because they were the ones who looked like a bomb had just gone off in the back of the car, you know, and they'd somehow survived. So you have to... So that may be, that's 10 or 15 years that kind of disappears. So that's, so then you look at your life and you say, what have I accomplished? You know, and I misplaced 10 or 15 years. Well, certainly those years, but why does it feel like I misplaced 20? And how much can you regret? And how much, you know, should you regret about that? And then finally, there's this whole other, as you get older, I mean, and 60 is the very beginning of it, I think. That's why I subtitled the book, you know, The End of the Beginning or The Beginning of the End. I mean, so I'm a young, older person. But one of the reasons I wanted to keep a diary of my 60th year is I noticed these physical changes. So one of the changes is I work as a roving writer at a newspaper, and I was at a story meeting. And I had just finished reading a book about voyages, early voyages around the tip of South America, around Cape Horn. And I was, you know, in the back of my mind, I was sitting in a meeting waiting for my turn to come up to pitch my stories to a big group of people in the room. And this other young guy got up before me and he said, you know, I really want to write a story about gay porn, about homosexual pornography. And so I said, fantastic, I'd love Cape Horn. I can't get enough Cape Horn. And he looked at me and he said, really? You know, I would never have pegged you. You know, and I said, well, come on, what's not to love about Cape Horn? You know, the towering mass, blah, blah, blah. This went on for about 5 minutes. And finally in the meeting, somebody said, are you saying Cape Horn? Because he's saying gay porn, and they're very different. And I realized, you know, my hearing was going. So I would possibly needed a hearing aid. Well, you get a hearing aid, and then you begin to think, well, this is the beginning of fragility. And but Walker, my son, you know, he's used to fragility. He lives with fragility every single day. And he shows me, because he doesn't think about fragility, because he makes whatever emotional connection he makes in whatever way he makes it with me. And he makes them. I mean, you know, I can be tired and not wanting to be involved, and somehow he will make something happen. If he can do that with his fragility, if he can turn it, make it, if it becomes not just fragility but a form of strength, then my own is thrown into very sharp relief, you know.
Absolutely.
And we're
going to take a break, but when we come back, we will pick up right here with perhaps some of the lessons that your son continues to teach you as you go through your own aging journey. We'll be right back. As we talk about your own experience of aging and certainly the gifts that you have acquired as you have experienced your son, I feel like I need to remind or let the audience know that approximately 10,000 people will turn 60 every single day for the next 19 years. Now, that is not for us to launch into a discussion about Social Security, but my goodness, 10,000 people are turning 60 every day for the next 19 years. So all
that's in North America alone.
So, you know, that just adds so much. So much fabric, if you will, to so much of a tapestry to your experience of turning 60, your diary of what that experience has been like. And again, weaving in the experiences that you personally have had with your son, with your daughter, who is the opposite of your son in many ways, to your mm-hmm. wife, to your family, just to your whole life. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and as you say, I mean, that conversation about, you know, what it does to Social Security, what it does to pensions, that's a whole other conversation. I mean, personally, I think the bowel management problem, you know, when there's that many 60-year-olds going, there's not going to be a free bathroom between, you know, here and Miami, you know, for men or women.
Anywhere.
It's very, also a very, very crabby society as well. You know, if you get to 60 and become more opinionated and more sometimes narrower and sometimes not. But no, it's a gigantic change. And one of the funny things about it is, one of the reasons I wanted to write a diary is that I find and did find there's essentially two main approaches. Once you get to be 60, you can either take the woe is me approach, which is many poets and many philosophers have taken that approach. As, you know, I'm going to die. I can't stop thinking about it. You know, Philip Larkin, the great British poet, you know, wrote Obad, a famous poem about this. He wrote The Old Fools, another famous poem about this. On the other side, there is, on the one hand, you've got depression. On the other hand, the other main approach seems to be delusion. When you have this massive self-help industry writing books like, you know, Sexy at 60 and, you know, Younger Next Year, things that are demonstrably false.
Wait. Are you telling me that 60 is not the new 40? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
So some days it can be the new 40, and I think some days it can be even the new 25. But in other days it can be the new 136. Essentially, what you realize the more you read about it, and I read a lot about it trying to keep this diary, is that people are petrified of getting older, because that's when we have to confront the fact that we really have very little control over what happens to us. You know, you can eat well, you can exercise all the time, you can do crossword puzzles till the cows come home, but you cannot control at what rate you decline, and you cannot control, you know, what's going to take you. And that loss of control, coupled with the calamity of suddenly realizing that you're running out of time, that forces people either into the woe is me school or into the I'm never going to die school, or more normally, as it did for me, they fall into both camps depending on the day. And I was waking up, and I never knew which it was going to be. One morning I'd wake up and I'd go, oh my God, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, how does life let us win and defeat us at the same time? Just the most graceless, hypochondriacal, wienerish, whining, whinging, doofus approach to things. One day, the next day, I'd be out of bed like, I'm never going to die, I'm going to do this and this and then pack everything in. And I got so exhausted pinging and ponging between these two extremes that I thought, what I'm really doing is I'm reacting to the way I'm supposed to react. I'm supposed to be the new 40, 60 is the new 40, or I'm supposed to be a responsible person who's taking care of himself now and being careful when he walks down the street, etc. And these two conformities, which are reinforced by the fact that 10,000 people are turning 60 every single day, say more and more and more people reinforcing these two conformities. I actually thought to myself, this does not feel true to me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to keep a diary every day of the stuff, not that's supposed to move me or that's supposed to make me feel younger or supposed to make me feel older. I'm just going to keep a diary of what actually happens, of the stuff that actually occurs, as opposed to the stuff that's supposed to occur. And interestingly, I found the continuous regimen of doing that and of liberating myself when I could from social expectation and concentrating on the stuff that actually moved me, it had this it's a simple act of craft, really, sitting down for 10 minutes or 15 minutes or an hour or two every day and writing about what happened or the best thing that happened or the worst thing that happened. It actually had this strangely therapeutic effect. I mean, I guess it's the same as meditating or chanting or singing or biking, but it freed me in a way from what normally happens. I mean, you get to be 60 and you think, oh God, it's like Woody Allen said, he got to be 60 and he wanted to read more, so he took a speed reading course. And they read War and Peace, and somebody said, oh, that's great, what's it about? And he said, it's about Russia. that's all you know. And that's what happens when you think, I'm running out of time, I've got to do more and more and more. And you start skipping over details. And that's, in a weird way, tragic, because even cognitively and psychophysiologically, your experience, your memory is made up of details. So if you skip over the details, you have no episodic memory to return to, and that's problematic. The diary forced me to pay more and deeper attention to less, and that turned out to be quite fantastic. And I will only add that the other, it also sort of helps me see my way through, that actuarial analysis that we all do as we get older. I want to read Cervantes and Don Quixote. I want to read Moby Dick. I want to read War and Peace. I like to throw in James Joyce's Ulysses. That's a lot of reading. I don't know if I've got enough time to do that. So you got to buy as I did the other day, a new frying pan, a cast iron frying pan. And I was looking at it, and I was thinking, this is the last cast iron frying pan I'm ever going to buy, because they last forever, right? And you're constantly facing these, have I bought my last car? I mean, is a Prius really the car I'm going to go out on? Will I really not buy that convertible I've always longed for? And you're constantly facing these existential challenges without the aid of actually sitting down, calming down, writing it down, letting it sit on the page, reacting to it in your diary. Without that daily discipline and aid, it's a pretty panicky time.
Absolutely. And it sounds like as you were engaged in your daily writing, you were also becoming more and more skilled at the craft of mindfulness, of being there in
Well, I didn't know it was
moment.
Called that, but yeah, I think that might be true. Yeah,
that's what it sounds like.
I mean, you know, it's a very different. You read the diaries of Virginia Woolf. You read the diaries of, Isherwood. I mean, John Cheever. Those people are geniuses. I mean, they seem to have the ability to just put down in a sentence that they're in a book they're keeping for their own purposes that nobody's ever going to see. They have the genius to make it fascinating. And so when you begin a diary of your own, you think, well, it's not going to be as good as Virginia Woolf or John Cheever. I mean, maybe thank God, given some of the agonies they went through. But it's not the point. They didn't approach their diaries trying to make them brilliant, and nor should one. When anybody like me or anyone else, it has to be. I have a friend who's a great American writer, Nicholson Baker. I once said to him, he gets up every day and he writes. He has to sit in the same chair. He's got to have the same posture. He's got to have the keyboard, the laptop, the same thing. And he writes every day for as much as he can, and he throws out 90% of what he writes. I said to him, well, what happens when you're blocked? I mean, it's hard for me to think that he ever is, but he is apparently at some times. And he said, well, at those times, my fallback many times is I write about the best thing that happened to me the day before or that day or whenever he's writing. I guess it's the day before in his case because he writes in the morning. And I said, really? Like, that happy? I mean, that sappy, that the best thing that happened to me yesterday. And he said, yeah, it's interesting because you might start with the cliched thing, but then you start debating it. You know, well, maybe that wasn't the best thing. Maybe the best thing was the look my daughter gave me when she said goodbye to me after lunch, or the lunch we had. I never get to see her. I got that lunch with her today. Fantastic. Or maybe it was the way the light was coming down the street. This morning when I went to the dry cleaners, it was still early in the day. It's getting to be winter here. The sun was very low. It sent these long shadows down the street and really made what is just an ordinary side street into a very beautiful thing. You can really, you don't need much is what I'm trying to say. I mean, you can write about tying your shoes. And if you stick to it, it's weirdly, to my surprise, becomes its own reward. And you're not writing about the thing that's supposed to be important. I mean, I'm a newsman, right? I'm a journalist. I barely have a soul. I'm constantly writing about what's supposed to be important, what other people tell me is important. This is not like that. This is the mining of the self to concrete purpose. And it's really interesting.
What it does, I think, is certainly for the listener, it really underscores the value of just making the commitment to write about anything, about tying your shoes, that there is value in the process of approaching the writing, and you don't have to pay attention so much to the content that you choose to focus on. And in fact, if you choose to focus on nothing, you may in fact find all kinds of magical mysteries in your writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I used to, when I got up in the morning, I used to read the newspaper. And that made me, not suicidal, but often approaching that. I mean, then I moved on to reading email. I would wake up, and the first thing I would read in the morning was email, and that made me genuinely homicidal. You know, that made me want to go out and commit crimes against other people, fools who were emailing. But I developed this habit of getting up in the morning and going to my bookshelves and finding at random a piece of a book that looked interesting and going in and finding a paragraph or two to read to start my day off with good prose, right? That's all I wanted to do, just a little snatch of good prose, and I would begin with that. And I found it really changed, and then I would sit down and write my diary. But it really changed the whole thing. And I mean, you could write a diary that consisted of each day's two paragraphs and nothing more. And I think this quasi-therapeutic, soulful settling would occur anyway, because it's as you say, you know, you can begin with nothing, but if you sit in the nothing for long enough, it becomes something.
And again, can become something actually wonderful. You describe a blossom as a great rush, and a garden as a bigger project that is always going to defeat you. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting space to be. Talk about what you meant, what you mean by that. That the blossom is the rush, the garden, not so much, but maybe so.
Yeah, well, I was trying to, you know, when you're keeping a diary, you obviously track to some degree your moods. And, you know, there are days when, as I think probably any writer or anybody who's engaged in any serious pursuit that they take seriously, you know, you have your ups and you have your downs. It's kind of like traveling, you know. One day it's fantastic, and the next day it's pouring with rain, and you're lost, and your passport is missing. But then that moves into another great day. And writing is, I think, a bit like that. And there were many days when I thought to myself, you know, I should never have done this. I should have made some money. I made some serious money, or at least made more money than I made. You know, I'd be able to retire in a bit of some comfort. You know, you think to yourself, well, you know, maybe you have these regrets. You think you know, you work at a newspaper and you try and write books in your spare time. But, you know, all the time you spend in the newspaper, you begin to think, and it's always interesting, right? I mean, I've written in the last year about beautiful art and politics and refugees. But, you know, they're flashy. They look great. They're like the blossom, you know.
Yeah.
But blossom fades. It dies and it falls off. The thing that is still there is the vine or the plant and the rest of the garden. And I got onto this garden stuff because in the spring of the year that I kept the diary, for my 60th birthday, my wife said, let's go to England. Because I had to scatter my father's ashes in the North Sea. He was an Englishman, with my brothers and sisters. But before we went there, we went to the Chelsea Flower Show in London. It was a big deal. You know, it's London, not an inexpensive town. And we were going to go from there and walk around the Cotswolds, which is in sort of, you know, east of London, west of London. Very pretty. And some of the most famous gardens, Sissinghurst, you know, where Peter Sackville West lived. And, you know, just fantastic gardens everywhere. English gardens. And my mother was an English woman as well. And she was a mad gardener. And she had a vast and beautiful garden, well, vast, but an expensive and beautiful garden, which, like most empires, was built on slave labor, you know, mine and my brothers and my sisters, you know. And from the very beginning, you know, since she didn't believe in reading, that was bad for your health, you needed sunshine, get outside. So we were constantly, you know, being forced out to weed her vast suburban tracts, you know. And so I had this very conflicted approach to gardening.
It
felt like oppression to me. But at the same time, you know, both she and my father had done it. My brother's a brilliant gardener. My sisters are. And so when I bought a house, a little tiny house with a little tiny garden, I began to try. But I'd always associated it with older people. You know, you don't take up gardening till you're in your 60s, I thought. Blah, blah, blah. So anyway, I go to the Chelsea Flower Show, which is the biggest single flower show in the world. It's held at the grounds of the Chelsea Hospital, which is a veterans hospital. And it's, you know, there's 200,000 people a day go through that thing. And, you know, the English are just berserk for anything with a flower or a plant or a this and a that. And they really take it seriously. And when I got there, I was completely absorbed in gardening. And and I realized that the people who I, and I was talking to tons of people, you know, Baroness Fuchs, who was on the House of Lords committee on gardens. Of course, the House of Lords has a committee on gardens, you know. And, you know, Baroness Fuchs was like, you know, this woman with a bright turquoise suit and the largest plate, you know, platter-sized spring hat that I'd ever seen in my life. Her, but many of the people who I found interesting were these young people, and they were all training to be garden designers. And I would say, well, why do you like gardening? And they'd say, because it's common ground, because you can never best it, but it always lets you come back and try again, because it's another form of diary, really. It's a form of continuous regimen that you don't have to do it for 7 hours a day. You can do it for half an hour and keep the garden and blah, blah, blah. And as I was going around, I suddenly realized that I was trying to, unbeknownst to me, I was trying to make some connection, I think, with my mother, you know, with whom I had a very complicated relationship, a very difficult person, and, you know, anyway, complicated. I write about it a bit in the book, but somehow I was trying. She, you know, had died several years before, and somehow by going to Chelsea, I was going back to England, going back to the heartland of the mania for creating a world of household art, of garden art, which is what she was trying to do. You know, because she was of that generation. She was too young to be a suffragette, but too old to be the second wave feminist, you know, the Germaine Greer. She was in that generation in between. And that's kind of the lost generation of feminism. It's the women who were really, really smart and capable, but didn't probably have a chance to get much of an education. They didn't have a chance to break through. The war happened, you know, they had to look after the kids. And so they became these geniuses of household and garden art. She was one of those. Great, great cook, brilliant cook, you know, very capable, good painter, brilliant seamstress, smocker, all that kind of stuff. All this huge energy. She should have been running an international arms company because she had the personality for that. But instead, she was, you know, forced into these other things. And I think gardening became one. And I realized one day, walking through the Chelsea Flower Show, thinking about this difference between a career spent paying attention to fripperies and blooms as opposed to the underlying root structure, and whether, in fact, I had done that or not, I suddenly realized that I was gardening to connect with her. Mm. It really was a complete surprise. I mean, you know what it's like when you suddenly have these sort of... But to do that, of course, you have to give yourself the luxury of pursuing something that, you know, I should probably be doing something more useful, more career-oriented, more retirement fund-oriented. But that's not the way things work.
Well, and sometimes I would suggest that building a retirement fund, if you will, of positive awareness and new awareness and new experiences, that might be pretty valuable as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's probably the most important thing. I mean, obviously, one has to keep oneself clothed and fed and housed, but the you know, so much of our what he realized writing this diary, of course, what I did anyway, is so much of my time is spent keeping up, you know, trying to figure out what I need to know. Whereas there's this whole other aspect of one's existence, which is figuring out what you didn't know you needed to know, learning what you didn't even realize you wanted to know, being surprised by the details of one's life. I mean, it's the difference between, you know, the stuff you need to live your life, which we spend so much of our time on, versus the stuff that makes your life worth living, which comes along at a less predictable rate.
You know, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, there was something that seemed to occur to you as you were thinking about and writing about the garden that you wanted to make sure you shared with your daughter. So when we come back, I'd like to pick up there. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be back in a moment. In the idea, there was a point that you make in your book, which, for those who may just be tuning in, 60, a diary of my 61st year, the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning. You make the point that you want to be sure to tell your daughter that if you have to do something perfectly, if you believe you have to do it perfectly, you will never try. If you know it will fail, but figure, oh, what the hell, you might just try. And that might just be the most important thing. Why was that important for you to share with your daughter?
Because it had been the great challenge of my own life. And continues, you know, to be, I think, is the challenge of many lives, is to not be intimidated by the possibility that something won't work out and to try it anyway. I once read an interview with David Hockney, who, you know, the great English painter, and who, like many, many painters and many musicians and many writers, actually began to do his most profound and interesting work after the age of 50 or 60. We have this delusion that everybody, if you haven't written, you know, Martin Amis, the great English writer, used to say, you know, if you haven't written your novel by the time you're 40, you'll never write it. And I used to think, oh God, you know, he's right. But he's wrong. he is so wrong. That in fact, you know, it doesn't matter who you talk about, Picasso, you know, Pablo Casals, and Matisse, you know, I mean, and it goes on. And in fact, Martin Amis himself has written brilliant books, you know, since he turned 50. But anyway, Hockney was about 65, and somebody interviewed him and said, you know, and Hawking's always trying new things. You know, he would paint. He was a brilliant painter, brilliant drawer, draftsman. But he took photographs. He started playing around with perspective. He managed to reproduce in paintings what Picasso had managed as a cubist on the canvas, and in sculpture. You know, he really big thinker. Anyway, at one point, this interviewer said, you know, when the color Xerox machine came out, you were making paintings on the color Xerox machine, and frankly, you know, they're not that great. And it's true, they're not that great. They're kind of lumpy and inadequate as art, at least in the beginning. And this interviewer said, like, how do you deal with failure? And Hockney said, I've never forgotten this. I'm not sure there is any such thing as failure. I think what you do, and he may have, you know, I think he was speaking of his role as an artist, but it's widely applicable to everybody. I don't think failure exists. I want to do something. I try it. I see what happens. I learn from it, and then I move on, without, for a moment, looking back to say, was that any good? You know, did it work? Did it not work? Why didn't it work? Why did it work? How can I use that piece of information properly? Blah blah blah. So leaving behind judgment and merely taking a more I would say Buddhistic, probably, or at least removed and less sentimental, more clear-eyed, non-judging view of what has happened. And, you know, having grown up in a house that was you know, where judgment was a steady diet, I was keen to convey to my daughter that the success of a project doesn't matter, but the level of your commitment to it does. I'm you know, still not sure if I've conveyed that, but I sure hope I have, because it, as I get older and I list off what I might be able to call an accomplishment, and which I still do stupidly, but when I list off those things, having conveyed that information to her is right at the top of the list always.
Speaking of lists and accomplishments, do you have a bucket list?
I do not, because I, you know, I'm such a self-indulgent, you know, person that I don't want to leave anything out. I don't want to limit my choice to a mere bucket list. And plus, I find it's a bit, you know, so you say, okay, I want to go to Machu Picchu. You know, that's on the bucket list. There's the bucket list. And there's something slightly depressing about the bucket list, because it kind of limits your options. And so you go to Machu Picchu and it rains all the time and you don't have a very good time. Well, then you think, well, I spent all that time going to Machu Picchu. It might be better to say, you know, there's this fantastic show of miniature boxwood carvings that just opened at the art gallery here in Toronto. And they're fantastic things. And nobody, for a long time, they couldn't figure out how anybody did them, because they're so, you know, in the space of a golf ball, the width and the depth of a centimeter, you've got 50 characters, everybody's got a hat, each hat has got a different, you know, biblical scene, but with weird little jokes. And you think to yourself, well, that's there, maybe I'll just pop in and see that. And it turns out that's as valuable as that, you know, disastrous trip to Machu Picchu. So I would prefer to find my bucket list every day rather than have one sitting up telling you what to do.
That sounds entirely reasonable to me. Tell me about the decision that you made one morning when you woke up and decided you were going to grow a beard and not cut it off for a year.
Yeah, I as soon as the year was over, I cut it off, because it really, first of all, my wife said to me when I grew it, she said, lose the beard. And I said, no, I'm keeping the beard because I no longer care about what the world thinks of me. I'm going to live, you know, I am going to set the thing, which was the whole impulse for doing it, you know, to shun convention. The problem is that my beard is white and gray, and it makes me look like, you know, a prospector from 1884, or, you know, during the gold rush. I mean, you expect me to have a sieve and a stool and a backpack, you know, with a donkey beside me. It is unbelievable how bad it is. And also, you know, it's, as she said, lose the beard. I said, no, I'm going to keep it. She said, oh, okay, but when you do, then you can have sex again.
Off comes the beard.
Yeah, I mean, she's, you know, very nice and very clear, but she did not want anything to do with it in any way. And so that was, but you know, it's a funny thing, the beard. It does liberate you. You think, okay, well, I do look like, you know, Yosemite Sam here, and that's not going to, that's not going to, really, nobody's going to come near you. So that's great. You carve yourself out some privacy and even a bit of loneliness, you know, and that, you know, as the great E.B. White once said, privacy and loneliness are gifts, you know, and they are things that, say, big cities can convey, but a beard can do it as well. It can, certainly mine managed to isolate me quite a lot. And the weirdest thing is that I would then see myself in the mirror, and I would think, who the hell is that guy? Like, what? What? Stay away from him. And I'd realize, of course, that I was looking at my own reflection. And I know this because in the course of writing this diary, I read a lot and talked to a lot of people and interviewed a lot of people. But, you know, you have this you think at 60 you're just beginning to get older. Well, when you start reading better, you realize, in fact, you've been aging since the moment you were born. And that things have, your brain reaches its maximum capacity at 20. And you get about 8 good years out of it, and then it begins to decay at 28. By 35, your skin is starting to fall apart. You have this stuff called elastin in your skin. I didn't realize I had elastin in my skin. That was only in my pants kind of thing. The elastin decays. So this is why in your 30s, and this is well noted in the scientific literature, people think that their noses start to get bigger in their 30s. But if they don't get there, what happens is that the elastin starts to collapse, and so your nose begins to droop a bit. And that alone would not make you think you had a big nose, but at the same time, the musculature and subcutaneous fat deposits in your face begin to sag and break down. And so your head actually gets smaller in your, I mean, it's like there's no end. Even your blood slows down in your 30s. You know, it's like it's so undignified. And so in your 30s, so as a result of the collapse of the elastin and the shrinking of your head, your nose actually, starts to look bigger. And your bones in your 40s. Anyway, the point is that we live this double life. We are aging from the moment we are born, and we deny it for as long as we possibly can until the aging other who is inside us, who we've never wanted to think about, finally pops out. As with every double life, it eventually comes a cropper. And there you're going, oh my God, I'm old. But as you get older, you go into this denial. So it's possible for me, for instance, like I'm sitting right now, I can see a guy across the room who is slightly balder than I am, and I'm 62, he's probably 42, but he is nevertheless slightly balder than me. And as I am looking at him, I am thinking to myself, oh my God, look at that poor guy and how much closer to death he is than I am. Because, the capacity to deny that all this stuff is happening is vast. Because, again, you don't want to think that you don't have any control or anything. And the great thing about a beard is that it forces you into, at least my beard forced me into remembering that I was, no spring chicken. I might be a summer chicken or a fall chicken, probably, but I am no longer a spring chicken. And I'm not a winter chicken yet, but, I'm passing through the chicken season. And the beard was like a steady reminder of that. And for that reason, it had a kind of, my wife thought I was trying to hide my face. I was trying to hide myself. I wasn't trying to hide. I wanted to use it as a reminder.
I have to say that you have given me expansive insights into the potential use of beards. And for that, I am appreciative. It is brand new learning. And as we close out our conversation today, is there a website that you can guide our listeners to for more dialogue about what you're writing about?
Yes, you can go to www.ianbrownwriter.com, and on that website there's a place to leave comments. There's places you can go and find the book and et cetera. There's a link to various book clubs and that sort of thing. So that, I think that's the easiest way to do it.
Sounds great. IanBrownWriter.com.
That's right.
Got
yeah.
it. Ian, thank you so much for
a
delightful...
A pleasure, Diane. Great time talking to you.
Thank you. It's been a delightful time. And as I said, I now have new insights into men and their beards. Thank you for that.
You never know when something interesting is going to come.
That's
along.
Very true. That's the joy, in my opinion, of Mind Talk. Folks, thank you for joining us today on this this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And Mind Talk is available to you on demand 24/7 by going either to mindtalk.org, which is mindtalk.org, or you can download the free Mind Talk app by going to the iTunes store. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, you can always send an email, question, comment, you decide. Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And as I close out today's conversation, I remind you once again, if it's unacceptable, well, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.